The maps will have to be redrawn today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. So just how big is that chunk of ice that broke away from an Antarctic ice shelf?
It is absolutely massive. These ice shelves are as big as small U.S. states.
This one's the size of Delaware. Also, a young woman left her home in a Russian republic to live in ISIS-controlled Mosul. Then she sent this message back to her mother.
Mom, I feel like I was reborn here. I regret all those years I spent in Dagestan. Don't you want to come here, too? I want to live with you. I want you to see my boy growing up.
Plus, the American helping Kenyans make their own brand of elite running shoes.
Kenyan running means excellence, and you can't make a running shoe that's anything less than excellent and call it a Kenyan running shoe.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Glad you could make it here this Wednesday. So Russia and Donald Trump Jr.'s emails may be all over the news this week, and we'll keep covering that story as it unfolds further, which you know it will. But today we want to start with something we think also deserves top news status, A68. That's the soon-to-be official name for that huge iceberg that just broke off from an Antarctic ice shelf. It's the size of Delaware, we're told, and holds twice the water volume of Lake Erie. Made me think of this movie.
You recall what you said about how polar melting might disrupt the North Atlantic current?
Yes.
Well, I think it's happening.
Okay, we're not facing a day after tomorrow scenario, but for an iceberg this size to calve, it does have serious implications. Just how serious? We've got Heidi Silvestro with us. She's a member of the Project Midas research team that's been monitoring the growing rift in the ice shelf for years. So let's just start with what just happened, Heidi, with the Larsen ice shelf. Describe this massive event for us and when the separation actually occurred.
Well, it's been a month and month in the making. And even though it's winter right now, the rift kept on growing very, very quickly throughout the winter. And just today, we finally received a satellite image confirming that the rift had completely cut off this huge iceberg from the Larsen C ice shelf.
Where will this iceberg go now? Does it just kind of float around until it melts completely?
Yes, exactly. So at the moment, the iceberg is still in one piece, but it's very likely that it will keep on staying in the Weddell Sea for a little while, and then it will keep on drifting towards the east.
Now, this part of the Larsen ice shelf in Antarctica is called Segment C. Describe the ice shelf to us. It's got to be huge if it's divided into sections.
It is absolutely massive. These ice shelves are as big as small U.S. states, and they are floating pieces of ice that are extremely thick. So the thickest point of the Larsen C ice shelf is about 1 kilometer thick.
So as you said, this chunk of ice was already floating on top of the water, so this calving event isn't going to raise global sea levels. But your research group has found that it might destabilize the rest of the ice shelf. Just explain how that works and what that could mean down the road.
Just because the ice shelf is right there against the continent, it is slowing down glaciers coming down from the land, going into the sea.
So you're basically saying that this part of the Larsen ice shelf was kind of acting as a dam, keeping other ice from flowing out.
That's exactly that. And now what we are quite concerned about is to see how the ice shelf will react to this massive calving event. And we did some modeling work. And we had a wide range of results. And some scenarios said that the ice shelf would not react very much. But some other modeling results said that the ice shelf could become quite unstable. So worst case scenario would be a collapse of the ice shelf.
A lot of changes in Antarctica have been linked to climate change, but this, according to your research group, is not. What did cause this? And does it relate at all to those other melting and fracturing events that are caused by warming temperatures?
Yeah, this is a good question. Basically, ice shelves always try to maintain their shape. So calving is just a very natural process for ice shelves to maintain their shape, to maintain their balance. But what we're observing today in many of the ice shelves around Antarctica is that they are indeed being impacted by climate change. And because these ice shelves are thinning more and more, these ice shelves are becoming more and more unstable. And eventually, this might lead to collapses of these ice shelves.
So right now it's the polar night in Antarctica. It's winter and it means it's dark 24/7. How do you actually monitor and measure a giant crack in the ice when it's completely dark?
We got a lot of help from satellites. One of my colleagues was using two satellites that take radar images every 6 days, and they can see through the polar night. But what's funny is that for the calving event, it's actually another type of images that we've used, looking at temperatures of the ground. And by looking at differences in temperature, we could see that there was water all around the iceberg, meaning that the iceberg was calving.
So one last thing, Heidi. I gather you and your colleagues all had bets on when this iceberg would break off. And it held on for much longer than you all expected. How does it feel that it's finally happened after really months of waiting and watching?
Yeah, it's true. So we all had bets and we all lost. It feels strange that it's finally arrived. But now it's the beginning of a new era. You know, we're going to keep on monitoring what happens on these ice shelves after such big calving events. So it's all very exciting. And we feel very fortunate that we were able to use these amazing tools to keep monitoring what is happening down there in Antarctica.
Heidi Silvestre there, a glaciologist at the University of St. Andrews in the UK and a member of the team that's been monitoring the break in Antarctica's Larsen C ice shelf. Let's turn now to someone else who's been paying close attention to developments in the Antarctic and the Arctic. It's Mark Serez. He's the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. So, Mark, we've just heard from Heidi Silvestre that her team believes this big calving event in Antarctica was not caused by climate change, but of course it's taking place in the context of big climate-related changes in the region. So just give us a snapshot of that bigger picture and how this one event fits into it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment of what's happening. I mean, these big calving events do happen. They've been happening ever since the Antarctic ice sheet has been around. But yeah, we're in a warming climate. Now, we had a breakup of the Larsen ice shelves A and B, and those do appear to have a climate change connection. What you have is this thing called hydrofracturing, where you get meltwater, a lot of meltwater getting into these big crevasses and basically wedging them open. And that was what was happening. But this event probably was not climate change. But there is, of course, growing concern out here that these sorts of fracturing events in the future could lead to a destabilization of some of these ice sheets, and that could be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, we know that the Earth is warming quickly, but there's been a lot of uncertainty over just how quickly those massive ice sheets in Antarctica in the south and Greenland in the north will melt. What is the latest science telling us?
Well, if we really look at some of the biggest changes, it's actually up on the Greenland ice sheet, out on the other side of the world, that is. Greenland is definitely a major contributor to sea level rise right now, partly because we have more calving of big icebergs, nothing like you're seeing in Larsen C, but big icebergs nonetheless, and just a lot of surface melt that occurs in the summer, which you don't see in Antarctica. But it's really part and parcel of what's happening for the world as a whole. Things are warming up. In some sense, the Antarctic ice sheet has been sort of this sleeping elephant. But a sleeping elephant that is now beginning to stir like the rest of the globe is.
Yeah, so what does that mean? Because all this melting ice is going to add presumably massive amounts of water to the world's oceans. So what are the best projections right now for sea level rise from polar melting over the rest of this century and beyond?
This is happening right now. It's the Antarctic, the Greenland ice sheet. And we're also seeing glaciers like in Alaska or through the Arctic really contributing to sea level rise. Now, the projections out there are maybe around a meter sea level rise by the year 2100. Now, depending on your point of view, that is not that big, something we can handle, or it is quite big and something that's going to cause big problems.
What's your point of view?
My point of view is that it will be a big problem for some places, but overall, as long as you have the money, we'll be able to handle it.
Yeah.
The problem is that the very countries who have done the least to cause climate change are those very countries that are going to be seeing some of the biggest problems because they really can't deal with it. But there's uncertainty out there in that sea level rise. It could be smaller. It could be bigger. And that's the concern out there, the uncertainty. Here we are fiddling with the dials on the climate machine, and we're not quite sure how things are going to turn out. And that's the thing that concerns me.
Speaking of money, I've got to ask you, you run this research organization that's one of the most important in the world in keeping watch over the polarized caps, but it's largely funded by the federal government in Washington, where there's a lot of hostility right now toward this kind of research and proposals from the Trump administration for big funding cuts and agencies that support climate research. How concerned are you about our ability to stay on top of crucial developments in climate change, given the mood in Washington right now?
Well, we're very concerned over this, of course. We do live in a very hostile environment in terms of climate change research, which has always puzzled me because this should be a very bipartisan issue because it affects all of us. We're managing the best we can. Our strategy out here is to just be very honest purveyors of the data and information, stick with the science and what's happening. We'll see what happens, but we do live in these rather interesting and rather uncertain times, and we are quite concerned about this.
Mark Serez is the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center and a professor of geography at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
To see how that giant crack in the Antarctic ice grew over the years leading up to today, head over to PRI.org. It's safe to say that Kenyans have a global reputation when it comes to long-distance running. Earlier this year, Kenyans won both the men's and women's marathon races here in Boston. And now in the Kenyan city of Mombasa, a new business is trying to cash in on that running prowess, a business with a U.S. connection. My BBC colleague Ferdinand Omondi has that story.
At a factory line in Mombasa, workers are producing a new set of shoes, hoping to write a chapter in Kenya's great running history. One worker fits the top pieces together, the other glues the soles, and so on. The shoes are called Enda, which is Swahili for go. I'm with Weldon Kennedy, an American who co-founded the brand with a Kenyan partner. The two raised $128,000 through an online campaign on a crowdfunding platform, and Enda was born. Kennedy says the focus is on quality, not quantity.
The important thing for us was not volumes per day on this first production run. It's quality, right? Kenyan running means excellence, and you can't make a running shoe that's anything less than excellent and call it a Kenyan running shoe.
Right now, they're only making about 150 pairs a day, but Kennedy hopes that number will increase over time.
So I'm holding one of the finished products here, and I can see different design elements which represents the Kenyan-ness of the shoe. On the side is a symbol of a spear. It is a symbol found in the national flag as well as different national symbols. On the side of the sole are 12 stripes, which I'm told represent the day when Kenya attained its independence, and that's the 12th of December. And of course, the shoes come in only three colors, black, red, and green, which are the colors of Kenya's national flag.
Weldon says they're working with local athletes to create shoes that live up to Kenya's reputation. In the rugged terrain of Eldoret in western Kenya, I meet Justin Lagat and Joanne Cherop wearing the striking red and black colors of Enda on their feet as they run down a winding tarmac road. They are the long-distance runners helping Enda test the shoes during the training. Justin is so far impressed with the shoes' performance.
After around 3,000 kilometers in them, and they are doing, so far, they are doing very well. I'm really proud of Enda because it is a shoe that's focused on Kenyan athletes and it's selling the brand of Kenyan running.
Back at the factory, a corner store is packed with shoes ready for sale worldwide through Enda's website. Orders have been coming in from as far as the US and Japan. It's a good start for Kenya's first homemade running shoe, but it still has several laps to go.
The BBC's Ferdinand Omondi reporting there from Mombasa, Kenya. Coming up, a controversial Korean Christian church is growing here in the U.S. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Late last year, the Church of England issued a rare warning. It told members to be on the lookout for a group trying to infiltrate parishes in London. That group is based in South Korea, where it's called Shincheonji. It calls itself a church, but critics call it a cult. Yesterday, we heard about the controversy surrounding Shincheonji in South Korea. Today, we hear from a follower here in the U.S. Here's the world's religion correspondent, Matthew Bell.
Shincheonji is a secretive group. Many of its members are not willing to speak with reporters, and they don't want their picture taken. But that's not the case with everyone.
My name is Michelle Ching. I am a theology lecturer at Shincheonji.
Chang says even though her family wasn't religious, she was always an on and off again Christian. In her late teens, she says she had a thirsty heart, so she turned to the Bible for answers. The more she read, though, the more she realized how much she didn't understand.
Around that time, when I was really seeking, where a friend reached out to me, and he introduced me to a Bible study, which became, I realized, was a Shincheonji Bible study.
That was 8 years ago. Chang describes it as a turning point in her life.
I was able to feel really that hole in my heart being filled with such joy because I was finally able to understand what I was not able to.
Chang says she still has a part-time job, but her volunteer work as a Bible study teacher with Shincheonji is her real passion. She says the church has grown in the U.S. with 15 branches and around 2,000 members, but it usually doesn't go by the name Shincheonji. Chang teaches at a place called the Zion Mission Center, for example, in Santa Ana, California. And she says it's true new students are not told right away that the center is affiliated with this controversial group.
We want people to make a decision based upon what they've learned in the Bible without having any skewed misunderstandings of what they might have heard of Shincheonji.
Many people I've talked with, and it will come as no surprise to you, they say that Shincheonji is a cult, and some say it's a dangerous cult. Tell me why Shincheonji, in your view, is not a cult.
Well, I would first ask them, you know, what is your definition of a cult? Is it one leader and followers? Is it believing in one teaching? If that's the case, then they are indirectly calling Jesus a cult. So the teachings of Shincheonji are different than what mainstream Christians might be used to, but everything that is taught in Shincheonji is according to the Bible, and there's nothing ever taken out of the Bible. And Shincheonji is not a cult, because a cult is saying something that God never said.
This sort of claim of total biblical authenticity sets off alarm bells for Rick Ross. He's the head of the Cult Education Institute in Trenton, New Jersey.
You know, many times I've heard people say that are involved in authoritarian Bible-based groups that have been called cults, that the leader is simply going with the Bible and what the Bible says, and the leader can support anything that he or she says through the Bible.
Ross says there are all kinds of cults, some benign and some dangerous. He says Apple, under the leadership of the late Steve Jobs, and things like SoulCycle have some cult-like characteristics. But one thing Ross says he's watching out for is the way members of a religious group view their leader.
The existence of a living charismatic leader that becomes an object of worship. That is, the group is personality driven and defined by the individual who is typically the founder leader of the group.
Critics of Shincheonji say the founder, Lee Man Hee, presents himself in ways that put the group's teachings far outside the Christian mainstream. For example, they say Lee's followers believe that he will never die. That's something I asked Chang about, too.
Do you believe that Lee is immortal?
I believe that God has the power to grant eternal life to those he chooses, including Mr. Lee.
Sounds like the answer is yes.
Yes.
After my interview with Chang, a Shincheonji member forwarded an email to me with a statement attributed to Lee Man Hee himself. It said, "I did not ever say I have eternal life. It's a misunderstanding." In his own book, The Creation of Heaven and Earth, Lee refers to himself as the promised pastor mentioned in the Bible. Rick Ross says this sort of claim raises serious questions about Shincheonji. He says another worrisome practice is the way the group appears to rely on deception to attract new members.
I would say that infiltrating existing churches with the ulterior motive or hidden agenda to recruit people by sitting in the back in the pews and then inviting them to a Bible study to siphon them into an alternative group is very deceptive, but commonly practiced by many groups that have been called cults.
Members of Shincheonji say they have no choice but to be secretive because they face so much persecution. Indeed, prominent Christian leaders in South Korea have denounced Shincheonji as a dangerous cult. For her part, Michelle Chang says people should come check out one of Shincheonji's Bible study classes and make up their own minds.
Shincheonji is not a bad place the way that people might think it is. It's not a dishonest place. It's not a deceptive place. It's a place that has appeared and teaches according to the Bible. And it would just be my hope and prayer for them to see that for themselves.
For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Before we head to the break, a heads up on a story we have coming up tomorrow. You may remember President Trump's speech in Poland last week. He delivered it in a very symbolic place, in front of a monument to the Warsaw Uprising, a reminder of Poland's painful wartime history. The 1944 Warsaw Uprising against the Nazis left tens of thousands of people dead and much of the city in ruins. But for many Poles, it's also a moment of national pride and honor. Tomorrow, we're going to take a look at another moment of Polish World War II history, one that's left a much murkier legacy that is especially painful still today. That moment was a wartime massacre in a tiny Polish town called Jawabna. The World's Nina Porzuki was there recently.
It's school break this week, and the village kids are assembled in the pews for church camp. A few girls pastor a young priest with a guitar about what to sing next. My producer, Ursula, speaks with the young popular priest. His name is Father Serafine. Will he talk with us about the history of the town? Sure, he says, after Mass. If wars leave scars, then Poland has a deep red gash through its middle. Poland was the epicenter of World War II in Europe. For 6 years, the country was fought on both fronts. Stalin from the east and Germans from the west. 5 million Poles died during the war, 3 million of those Polish Jews. That's one-fifth of the population. No village was untouched. And today, if you walk around any Polish town or village, big or small, it's impossible, it seems, not to bump into some monument commemorating the war. What does this do to a nation?
The monument in Jawabna commemorates that massacre I mentioned a moment ago. This week marks the 76th anniversary. Nina's story will take a look at what that painful memory means for people in Poland today. That's tomorrow, right here on the show. I'm Marco Werman. He's the man who helped make Paul Simon's Graceland album sound so good.
I will always remain in people's heads, minds, hearts, soul, spirit. I will give without being asked to give.
Remembering South African guitarist Ray Piatti. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The battle for Raqqa, the Islamic State's de facto capital in Syria, has been raging for weeks. And on the face of it, that might seem like a faraway story for us here in America. But consider this. Last week, the casualties in Raqqa included two Americans who were fighting against ISIS, 29-year-old Nicholas Warden of Buffalo, New York, and 28-year-old Robert Grote, who came from California and was once a volunteer medic in the Occupy Wall Street movement. The World's Rich Hall has been looking into the two men's stories from his base in Beirut. He says both of them were fighting alongside Kurdish forces in Syria, and that Warden brought years of U.S. military experience to the battlefield.
He served with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan, and he also spent a few years in the French Foreign Legion. So he obviously wanted to use his skills for a cause he believed in.
Right, and he made a video shortly after joining the Kurdish fighters. In it, he's sitting on a stool with a rifle in his lap in a lush green field. I got to say, it could be Kansas, but it's Syria. Let's hear that.
I joined to fight ISIS because of the terrorist attacks they were doing in Orlando, in San Bernardino, in Nice, in Paris. I have a high school education. I received military training and tactics and language training in the YPG. I'd like to say hi to my parents in New York.
So YPG, that would be the YPG, the Kurdish forces he was fighting for. Warden's father said his son had also fought against Boko Haram in Chad. The Kurds, they must have been pretty happy to have a fighter with his experience on the front line.
Yeah, and actually lots of the Western volunteers that are going to join them have military experience. And Yeah, you have experienced fighters from the UK and from the US who have, some of them have fought against ISIS forebearers in Iraq. They would have fought against Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was the group that gave birth to ISIS. So for many of them, it's unfinished business. They're coming back to finish the job.
What do we know, Rich, about the other American who was killed, this man, Robert Grote?
Yeah, Grote sounds like a very different character. He was from Santa Cruz in California, and he was an activist involved in the Occupy Wall Street movement. I mean, he actually made the papers in the U.S. when he met his partner during the protests there. She was sprayed with some pepper spray during those protests, and he went to help her. And there was a famous viral video of him going to help her, and their romance blossomed from there, and they had a daughter together, and she's now 5 years old.
Grote also made an online video when he joined the YPG, and it starts out with some shots of him holding a cardboard sign that says, "Can we occupy now?" Maybe some reference to his days at Occupy Wall Street. Sitting in a field, the same one as Warren, on a stool with a rifle, finger near the trigger. Let's hear Robert Grote.
My reasons for joining the YPG was to help the Kurdish people in their struggle for autonomy within Syria and elsewhere. Also to do my best to be able to fight Daesh and help create a more secure world. You know, for my family, there's way too many of you to be able to speak to individually. Just know that I love you all, and there's a lot that goes unsaid. To my daughter, I'm sorry that I'm not there. Just know that I love you all.
A poignant and sad message to his daughter. The majority of Kurds are Sunni Muslims. Were Warren and Grote followers of Islam?
No, there's no indication that they were. And it's interesting, these two guys, they actually represent the two type of people, the two type of Westerners that are going over to fight with the YPG. So on the one hand, you had Warden, who was this soldier who was repulsed by ISIS. And I think he saw himself as kind of a protector. He references the terrorist attacks in San Bernardino and Paris and Nice. And obviously, he was driven by this hatred of ISIS first and foremost. And then you have Grote, this activist, this Occupy Wall Street guy. And for him, it seems like it was more of an ideological battle. And he was actually, it seems like he was there to support the ideology of the PKK and the YPG. The PKK is kind of the umbrella group that includes the YPG. And they're kind of a Marxist group. They have an aim of democratic confederalism. And many, many radical leftists in the West see what they're trying to do in Syria as kind of a utopian project. You have anarchists and socialists looking at what they're trying to do there and what they're trying to build, and they want to go and support that. And I think that was the case for Grote.
So we've now witnessed the routing of ISIS from Mosul in Iraq. Raqqa in Syria is the stronghold there. What's the status now of the battle for Raqqa?
So yeah, the battle for Raqqa is very much underway now. There's kind of a ragtag army led by Kurdish forces. You also have Arab fighters alongside them and these Western volunteers. And also recently there was a contingent of Yazidi women who joined the fight from Sinjar. You remember the Yazidis were the victims of a horrible ISIS attack and a genocide against them. And thousands of Yazidi women were kidnapped. And you now have women from Sinjar, where that attack happened, coming to join the fight. There are hundreds of U.S. Marines on the ground in a supporting role, and they're being backed by U.S. airstrikes. They're making steady progress in Raqqa. They have taken sort of the old city in Raqqa, which is a crucial part of the city. There's still a huge amount to be taken. The U.N. say there are around 50,000 civilians trapped behind enemy lines being used as human shields. And we've also had reports of quite high civilian casualties, just like we did in Mosul. So there's definitely a long battle ahead. And then after Raqqa, we've got further south, Deir ez-Zor. So there's still a lot of fighting to be done.
The world's Rich Hall in Beirut. There are also foreign fighters on the other side of the battle in Raqqa. Young men and women from around the globe have gone to both Syria and Iraq to join ISIS and be part of its so-called caliphate. Thousands of these recruits are thought to have come from just one region in Russia, Dagestan. Many of them come from remote villages there, like the village of Karada, which PBS special correspondent Nick Schifrin visited recently. In a story airing tonight on the PBS NewsHour, Schifrin meets parents whose children joined ISIS. He says just getting to the isolated village was a challenge.
You're on the side of mountains. You're on dirt roads that are barely paved and sometimes going at an incline of 12 or 18 degrees up the side of a mountain. These are extremely isolated places.
So in Karada, you spoke with one woman, Amina Kondakova, whose daughter Miriam and son Ali Alshkat slipped away. What did she tell you about how that all happened, how they left the village?
Amina is a Muslim convert, and she believes, looking back, that Amina and Ali Alshkat and some other members of the family were slowly radicalized online. Amina became more conservative. The perception that mother has is that the daughter felt judged. The daughter felt like she couldn't live the version of Islam that she wanted to. And ISIS offered that. And that's what the Russian propaganda of ISIS did. It reached into these towns and said, Russia doesn't care for you. Come here. Come here to the caliphate.
So the daughter goes to Mosul, has a child with an ISIS fighter. Let's hear a moment from your story on the NewsHour. This is a voiceover of the mother, Amina, describing how her daughter explained to her what her new life is like with ISIS.
Mom, I feel like I was reborn here. I regret all those years I spent in Dagestan. Don't you want to come here too? I want to live with you. Want you to see my boy growing up.
So, Nick Schifrin, what does Amina Khondakova think is actually the fate of her children?
It is so heartbreaking to listen to that again and again. For a daughter to tell her mother, I've wasted my time where we lived, and here is where I was supposed to be all my life. I mean, can you just imagine? It has nothing to do with Dagestan, just a daughter telling her mother that. And sadly, Amina probably won't say this out loud, but Amina's daughter's probably dead. She hasn't heard from her in 4 or 5 months. And Amina's daughter went to Mosul while, you know, the Iraqi military with the help of the U.S. has essentially flattened much of that city in order to get ISIS out of it.
How is Amina reconciling all this? Because there's also her son.
There is a sense of what did I do wrong? And there's a sense of anger at not only ISIS and its propagandists, but the things that we talked about that Russia has done, which is not provide these children an economic hope, have a very brutal crackdown by the police and security services, and a part of the story we go into tonight, which is that as ISIS was recruiting Dagestanis, Dagestani security services showed some of these radicals the door. There were people who were on federal wanted lists who got passports to travel to Syria. And those people got passports, according to one of them who talked to me in Turkey, because the FSB, the Russian security service, was wanting to kick them out. And I spoke with someone on the record who was part of that program, and he says, look, it worked. Dagestan is now safer. These people left and they will never come back.
Wow.
There are people in Russia who believe, who argue that some of Russia's airstrikes in Syria are designed not to target ISIS, but to target specifically Russian fighters, Dagestani or Chechen fighters in ISIS, so that they never come back. And the people who are escaping, whether to Lebanon or Turkey or to Ukraine, are also being told, don't you dare come back because we won't, you know. Hint, hint, the sentence doesn't have to end, right? Just don't come back, dot, dot, dot.
Wow. So you also spoke with a man in the village named Kazim, whose son Murat joined ISIS, and now Kazim is raising Murat's son, Kazim's own grandson. Tell us about Kazim. It's a really poignant moment in your story.
His son goes to ISIS, and he doesn't sit back. And that's the extraordinary thing about this story. He went to Aleppo to argue with his son, to argue with ISIS fighters, saying, you guys are deluded. Please come back with me. It took him years. Kazim's wife went to Aleppo and stayed for a month, basically lived under the so-called self-declared caliphate, trying to convince their son to leave. And in the end, it worked. Kazim's son, Murat, is now in Odessa, Ukraine. And so he escaped. He escaped ISIS. Wow. And so Kazim has this pride. He wanted to deliver the message of, hey, all of those people who still have children in Syria and Iraq, it is not impossible to get them out. Don't give up on them.
Nick Schifrin, special correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, historian, the children of Dagestan leaving their families to join ISIS in Syria, airs tonight on the NewsHour. Nick, good to speak with you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Nick's work in Dagestan was supported by the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. If you visited websites like Wikipedia or Reddit today, you may have noticed something different. That's because those tech giants and thousands of other websites and companies are participating in a day of action. They're protesting plans to roll back rules protecting net neutrality. The maker of the Firefox web browser, Mozilla, is on the long list of companies participating. Danelle Dixon is chief legal and business officer at Mozilla. So, Danelle, I take it you've managed to explain net neutrality to your three young sons, which is good because whenever someone asks me what it is, I have trouble. My shorthand is equal opportunity for all websites, but I feel that's kind of insufficient. Just remind us what net neutrality is.
I think that's a good start. But the notion and the principle behind net neutrality is that there should be no ability for any company or entity to be able to throttle, block access, not allow certain content, require paid prioritization for content to anywhere on the web. The end user should be able to choose that. So if you think about it from that standpoint, it's just all about the end user having choice as to what content they want to have access to. That's really what net neutrality is all about.
What is the opposition to net neutrality here in the U.S.?
Currently, the opposition is that ISPs, internet service providers like Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, they want to be able to create their own rules and regulations around how they provide content to their end user and want more flexible rules to be able to work their business to the way that they need to.
What is Mozilla's actual action today on this day of action?
So we have several different things that we've done leading up to this. We've actually created on, if you can find this on Mozilla's YouTube channel, we have over 50 hours of voicemails that we've collected to send to the FCC.
Wow.
And what we've done in that YouTube channel is actually have, we've compiled 9 hours of it so that we have a very soothing voice reading this content to folks so that you can take a look at that and see what real users and real consumers care about with respect to net neutrality.
Your company has a pretty wide global reach. Are you fighting similar battles abroad?
Yeah, net neutrality is important everywhere. And we continue to watch for regulations. We watch, and especially in those markets where, in those regions where they're just coming online. India, we expect this year that we'll see some regulation there, and we think it's going to be pretty positive. We also, in Europe, for the most part, the regulation and legislation is all set, and really it's about enforcement. Mm. And so we engage when we can on those issues in Europe as well. But we take a pulse across as many regions as we can because this is a crucial issue. We, just like everybody, cares about open access to content and just this protection of this global asset. And this is the most important way to be able to do that.
Are there any countries as significant as the U.S. that are trying to roll back net neutrality?
The U.S. and what the U.S. is committed to do is rolling back the regulations that they put in play. We don't see that elsewhere. We do see, though, in other regions, even in Europe, there's bits and pieces of net neutrality rules that get chipped away from time to time. But nothing as severe as what's happening today in the U.S.
And briefly, what's at stake if net neutrality is reversed?
I think it's really important for people to just try to focus on what it actually means to them. The vast majority of Americans have access to two or fewer choices for internet service providers for their homes. So if you think about the fact that if I went down the street to my neighbor's house and I was watching a piece of content that I was very interested in and wanted to come home and show it to my 16-year-old, and then I came to my house and we didn't have net neutrality rules in place and I couldn't get access to that content because I had a different internet service provider that blocked access, that would be really damaging to my access to the free web. I also think that if you think about ISPs and Comcast, for example, owns NBC. And so what if Comcast decided to those users who have only access to Comcast or that's their ISP, they only provided you the NBC content so that you only had the news from NBC and the content that was available for NBC, or that was provided to you first. And then thereafter, anything, any other content that you wanted to view, there was a charge for, or it was much slower. It really degrades your ability to see the world, the full view of the world, and to have access to content from everywhere.
Danelle Dixon, she's Chief Legal and Business Officer at Mozilla. So how do you say, I love it in Russian? One of the many, many questions I have about the whole Donald Trump Jr.'s email stories going down in Russia this week. In case you need a recap, I'm talking about the email chain where Trump Jr. was offered some damaging information on Hillary Clinton during last year's presidential campaign, information that he was told came from the Russian government. Arkady Ostrovsky is Russia editor for The Economist and author of The Invention of Russia, The Rise of Putin, and The Age of Fake News. Arkady, how is this saga being covered in the Russian media?
Well, the Russians have been very sanguine in the media about it, and Putin and his man and women at the Kremlin are, are sort of have this air of, we're really surprised. You know, has America gone completely bonkers? You know, what is going on? Why are they paying so much attention to this thing? There is a degree of genuine surprise, I think, in Moscow, and how big the story has become. You know, this is a sort of conspiracy that Putin does, that Russia does very well, blaming everything on a foreign power. And suddenly he sees America doing that. And I think there is a sense of what is going on in America, even though he obviously knows perfectly well that Russia did hack into Hillary Clinton's campaign computers. But he just didn't expect it to create this complete, you know, outrage and uproar.
So, I mean, if you believe this, the surprise is sincere, I mean, do they even believe the story in Russia?
They believe something is going on, and they think it's going on for domestic U.S. reasons. Putin is somebody who does believe in American conspiracy. He also has been practicing anti-Americanism and blaming everything on America himself over the past few years. To see America do that, I think, to him is a genuine surprise, because he understands, and probably not wrongly, that while he was certainly trying to damage Hillary Clinton, he did not cause the victory of Donald Trump.
He doesn't believe that.
I don't think he does. And I, you know, to be perfectly honest, I don't think, you know, we have evidence of that either. We have evidence that they hacked into the computers. We have evidence that they meddled. They interfered in the election process. But it doesn't necessarily follow that this was the main cause of the Trump victory.
What would you say was the Kremlin's ultimate goal in the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign? Was this about destabilization? Was it about a specific policy outcome?
Right. So the goal, I think, was to destabilize the country, to destabilize the institutions, to create a degree of sort of chaos that could be exploited and shown on Russian television to the Russian public, saying, look, this is a really messy process. Look at this, you know, democratic procedures. They're just exactly the same as we are. It was sort of trying to play to the common denominator, to the lowest common denominator, and just trying to seed chaos. I don't think that Putin actually, in his wildest dreams, could think that his special measures, or his active measures, which is how this sort of subversion campaign used to be known in the KGB days, could actually have such an effect and coincide with the victory of Donald Trump. I think when Trump won the elections, they were clearly delighted. But I think they were realistic enough not to attribute Trump's success to their own campaign.
Is there a sense in the Kremlin that maybe their attempt to influence U.S. politics may be backfired? For example, it's surely very difficult for Trump to ease sanctions on Russia right now.
I think it completely backfired. Look, Russia has become completely toxic in the U.S. politics. Whatever it is that Trump thought he might be doing with Vladimir Putin in their first meeting, I think his ability to do so is clearly limited by domestic U.S. politics. There is one thing that Putin had a glimpse from this story, is how vulnerable and open America is to this sort of influence. I think that in itself actually could have much more damaging consequences than this particular story, because what he sees now in America, he has this joy of recognition. He recognizes that America works exactly in the same way, and therefore it can be probed, it can be infiltrated much easier than he might have imagined a couple of years ago.
Arkady Ostrovsky, Russia editor for The Economist and author of The Invention of Russia. Thanks very much for your thoughts.
Thank you.
And finally today, a recognizable intro from Paul Simon's Graceland album. That's actually a live performance of the tune I Know What I Know in South Africa. The man behind that guitar lick was South African jazz legend Ray Peattie. I had heard a couple of days ago that he was ill, and today we receive the news that Piri has died after a battle with lung cancer.
Well, we do open up this bulletin with some breaking news coming in. Legendary jazz musician Ray Piri has died.
Raymond Chigaba Enoch Piri has passed away. Piri was a South African jazz fusion. And
President Jacob Zuma has extended his heartfelt condolences on the passing of late jazz musician Mr. Raymond Piri, who passed on today, 12 July 2017.
His death has been dominating the news in South Africa today, with eulogies to the guitarist from people from all walks of life. He touched a lot of people with his music, but also with his honesty. He was frank about the way musicians were treated in the music business, often as an afterthought to the profits made by record companies. Like a few years ago when Piri was honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award by the South African music industry, when a reporter asked him for his reaction to an award for his life's work, this is what Piri said.
It's like they're saying to me, hey, come here, take a bow, and get out of here. But I'm not going to get out because I will always remain in people's heads, minds, hearts, soul, spirit. I will give without being asked to give. And I will take without asking also, because it's a two-way traffic.
Ray Piri speaking there to South Africa's Eyewitness News TV channel in 2012. We leave you today with music from Stimela, Piri's longtime ensemble in South Africa. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being here.
PRI, Public Radio International.